We talked in a previous study about what happened to the Jews in medieval Europe, which sounded pretty terrible, and it was pretty terrible to the point where many of the nations got to the point where they were issuing what were called edicts of expulsion, where they were literally kicking all the Jews out of their countries. England did this in 1492. As a matter of fact, the very day that Columbus left Spain, the edict of expulsion that was issued by Ferdinand and Isabella went into effect that very day in 1492 when Columbus left Spain, that all the Jews had to be out by then. As I said, they were already driven out of England. Less than 100, or about 100 years after 1492, the Jews were allowed back in England. It seemed to depend on what king was in charge and what the financial situation of the country was as to whether or not Jews were allowed in. And in this case, they were allowed in the late 1500s. But anti-Semitism still permeated the continent. All of Europe still had this Jewish thing going on. The Reformation had taken place during this time. That we, you know, as Protestants, we look at the Reformation and we say, what a great thing to happen. What a wonderful thing to happen that we could get back to the Bible. And yet, as we looked at it, especially in the beginnings of the Reformation, as we read even the points that Martin Luther nailed to the Wittenberg door, that we came to the conclusion that this was not, it's not like we went from Catholicism to Calvary Chapel inside of a year or so. It just didn't happen that way. So the Reformation really didn't help the Jews at all. As a matter of fact, if you've ever read Martin Luther's writings, and you can say, wow, what an amazing commentary on the book of Romans Martin Luther had. But then you read Martin Luther's last book. It was published in 1543, and his last book was called On the Jews and Their Lies. So this founder of Lutheranism, this instrument that God used in the Reformation to really, not to begin it, that's a bit simplified, but to really be used to propagate the Reformation, was clearly anti-Semitic. And I'll read you the opening paragraph of this book. The opening paragraph of Martin Luther's final book said, I had made up my mind to write no more, either about the Jews or against them. But since I learned that those miserable and accursed people do not cease to lure to themselves even us, that is the Christians, I have published this little book so that I might be found among those who opposed such poisonous activities of the Jews and who warned the Christians to be on their guard against them. So this was a man who had fully bought in to the lies propagated against the Jews throughout Europe. In this book, he claimed that converting Jews to Christianity was impossible, literally impossible to convert a Jew to Christianity. The reason being, he said, quote, it is impossible to convert the devil and his own, nor are we commanded to attempt this. So his position in this book was, you wouldn't try and lead the devil to Christ. Why would you try and lead the Jew to Christ? He also recommended that his fellow German Christians should, quote, set fire to their synagogues and schools, and to bury and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. This is to be done in honor of our Lord. So the situation, clearly not good for the Jews at the moment. But it seemed that there was hope on the horizon. It seemed like things were about to change, and they were about to change. As a matter of fact, in 1783, and again, this is another 200 years passing by, but in 1783, there was a Jewish philosopher, German Jewish philosopher named Moses Mendelssohn, and he translated the Torah into German. So now the scriptures, the Jews have the Old Testament in German. What did this do? Well, what it did was it became essentially their textbook for learning German, for learning current German language, which had they did not, you know, there was Yiddish, which was kind of a mixture of German and Hebrew, but they were very ostracized and in their own communities. And suddenly, as they began to learn the German language from this translation of the Torah, they used this to teach themselves to read and to write and to speak German. And what happened was, operating in the native language of the land, it enabled the Jews to participate in German life in a way that they had never been able to before. Suddenly, hey, we're just one of everybody else kind of thing. And so they were able to participate in German life, in German science, and in German culture. And no longer were they stuck in these communities, these little communities were largely cut off from the nation around them. And so this resulted in the Haskalah, which is, for our terms, the Jewish Enlightenment. This resulted in the Jewish Enlightenment, which encouraged the integration of Jews into European society, wherever they might be. The Jewish Enlightenment, it's a very, very big point in history among the Jews, where it was like, suddenly, hey, we're part of everything. And it involved the secularization of the Jewish people, meaning, you know, that it's like, okay, this is going to be less about religion and more just about we're part of everything. And a lot of Jews very quickly became part of the community at large as educated doctors and lawyers and surgeons and bankers and all kinds of professional, they set up their shops and clinics and offices and things in the midst of the people, the Russian people and the German people and a lot of these European nations. And this was thought of as the emancipation of the Jews, the political emancipation, you know, that they'd finally been set free and freely integrated into society. And so at that point, many people, especially Jews, got to thinking, hey, all this anti-Semitism thing, it's coming to an end. We're integrated into society and we're part of it. And this is when Reform Judaism, if you're familiar with basically the three, this is again simplified, but the three denominations of Judaism today. There was, you know, there's Reform Judaism and Conservative and Orthodox. Well, this is when Reform Judaism came about, which is a liberalization of Judaism, essentially. Because with their higher learning, a lot of Jews came to the conclusion that, you know, God didn't write the Bible. And so they got to the point where it was like, okay, this is an important cultural thing of our history, but, you know, there's no need for us to follow these laws strictly. Certainly they're not from God. And so let's just kind of pick and choose. And so, a lot of them got to the point where they allowed each person to decide for himself which laws of God they were going to follow or what traditions or customs that they were going to observe. And today, if you're familiar, if you know Jewish people today, odds are they're Reform Jews because Reform Judaism is today in America the largest Jewish denomination there exists today, as opposed to Conservative, which is less liberal, and then Orthodox, which is pretty ultra strict. If you recognize somebody and you see them and they're dressed like a Jew, you know, then you figure, okay, they're Orthodox, they're observing all these things. So you would think that at last every offense that people had taken against the Jews would have kind of been out the window, because now they're integrated into society. It's not like there's this big fear of it's those people that live in that little community, you know, a number of miles away. They don't speak our language. They look different than us, because this Jewish Enlightenment meant that the Jews of Europe were dressing like the other citizens of Europe, and they were interacting, and there wasn't this stereotype of the Jewish money lender as there was in the days of medieval Europe. So you'd think that all that kind of stuff had just sort of come to an end, but you have to remember that there's a spiritual battle that goes on, and the devil wasn't about to let the Jews fade into the woodwork of Europe and just kind of assimilate, because the devil hates God's chosen people. And so what he was able to do, essentially, even though the Jews wouldn't be singled out religiously as they were in the past, or by being moneylenders or whatever, that what he did was he was able to make nationalism come on the rise. And nationalism, if you're not familiar with what that is, nationalism is this position that views national identity on ethnic terms. It's something that the politically correct lobby today is trying to say, hey, what's an American? And they show you commercials of, look, and they show you people of all different races and things and say, what's an American? Whereas, you know, if you go down to the South and you talk to, you know, Joe Bob driving his Chevrolet pickup truck, you know, you say, what color is an American?
He's white.
You know, and well, what does he look like?
Well, he looks a lot like me. He drives a Chevy. Maybe a Ford, but I doubt it, you know. He wears Levi's, not those made in China Walmart jeans.
You know, and he's got this idea, because he's a nationalist. He's like, an American's an American. Well, all throughout Europe, nationalism began to really take hold, and especially in Germany, this idea of the Aryans was a real German was an Aryan. That's a Caucasian person who's not a Jew. That's the simplest definition of Aryan that you can come up with. It's a white person that's not Jewish. So this idea really took hold, and the Jews, because they had, you know, they had descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and by and large had kept their lineage very pure. They had followed the law. They had intermarried in the Jewish community, as opposed to getting a lot of external blood out in there. And so you have, you know, a few, this is going to be the wrong word, but a few species of Jews where you can look and you say, that's a Jew, and that's a Jew, and that's a Jew. They don't look like anybody else. If you ever open up a picture book of Israel, you can see, oh, yeah, okay, I can see that. I recognize the nose and the eyebrows and certain, you know, facial features, and clearly they're Jews. Well, clearly they were Jews. Clearly they were not Aryans, and the nationalism, that position, again, singled out the Jews as outsiders, even though they had assimilated in. They were dressing the same as other Europeans, that they were operating the same as other Europeans. It didn't matter. They were clearly not Germans. Clearly, you're not a German. So this, in spite of the adaptation to the culture, the Jews are obviously very visibly outsiders, and differentiation turns into discrimination, which leads then again to full-blown anti-Semitism. And again, I'm sort of focusing on Germany tonight, but this is all throughout many of the European nations. Russia is specifically a point of study in this as well. A lot of governments, including Russia and Germany, began to see that they could blame, the politicians could blame the Jews for anything that was wrong. It's like, well, the economy's falling apart. Well, blame the Jews. Say that they're manipulating the economic system. Food shortage. Oh, say that the Jews went in and poisoned the crops or soiled the soil or whatever, you know, blame the Jews. If there's political upheaval, say, oh, well, these people who oppose me, they're just stooges of the Jews. Even if they weren't Jews, it didn't matter. Oh, they're following Jewish leading. They could use the Jews to place the blame of just about anything they wanted to. And it was very effective because they're the different people. They're the ones, they're not real Russians, or they're not real Jews, or I'm sorry, they're not real Germans. They're not really part of our nationalistic society. So what happened is, by the 1880s, this resulted in full-blown massacres of the Jews, the pogroms, P-O-G-R-O-M, a pogrom. It's an organized massacre. They broke out in Russia in the 1880s, and they continued on for about the next 30 years off and on, that you know, the Jews would be blamed for something, and like lynch mobs would come in and attack and kill. Hundreds of Jews were killed during this time. Thousands more were wounded. And the pogroms resulted in many of the Jews in Russia and a lot of Eastern Europe emigrating to the United States, which we saw the birth of in our last study or two, the discovery, so-called, the discovery of the North, Central, and South American land and the settlement and the colonization of it. Well, by the late 1800s, it's very open to receiving immigrants. And so many of the Eastern Europeans, the specifically Russian Jews, came over. As a matter of fact, my wife Judy, her family came, both sides of the family actually, both mom and dad's side of the family, came from a little village in Kiev in 1913. So it was during this time that a lot of Jews went, well, this is very dangerous, we need to move, and went to clear to the other side of the world to start a new life. And so by 1925, there were 4.5 million Jews in the United States. But there were millions more left in Europe in this kind of hotbed of anti-Semitism. It didn't stop them from remaining integrated. They continued to, as part of the Jewish Enlightenment, as part of the secularization, they continued to do the best that they could to integrate, to say, hey, we're just like everybody else, and served in the military. There were tens of thousands of Jews who fought with the Germans in World War I as part of the German army. But in 1919, when World War I came to an end and Germany had lost, clearly had lost, Germany is licking its wounds, you know, from defeat. And the Treaty of Versailles, if you know your World War I history, the Treaty of Versailles was signed, which basically said, Germany, this is all your fault. And so you have to give back France and Poland, and your military will no longer be allowed to get this big again. And so you're limited. I forget if it was something like 100,000 or something. Their military was very, was clamped down on and could not exceed past a certain number. And they were financially responsible for all the damage that they had caused during all of World War I. So, you know, that's quite a bill to pay. And the problem was that if you can imagine, if we actually full on lost a war, like we surrender, we're going to sign a treaty, kind of losing a war, it would be hard for you and I to accept. Because if you think about it, you look back and the vast majority of our history, we don't lose wars. Well, with Germany, it was the same thing. We don't lose wars. And they had brutally lost a war. And a lot of German citizens, especially with their sense of nationalism and what had happened, and that they could not accept that they had actually been defeated on the battlefield. They needed to find another reason why they lost. And this became the "we were stabbed in the back" theory. This became the "this was not a loss on the battlefield. We lost because this was an inside job." Who did it? The Jews and the communists. The Jews and the communists were to blame, according to many German citizens. The Jews and the communists were to blame for Germany's loss of World War I. Now, a corporal in the army at the time, named Adolf Hitler, he became fanatical about this theory. Really, his hatred of the Jews was clear, and when he heard this theory and bought into this, he propagated it vehemently. He actually was sent undercover. He was kind of a spy of some sort, and sent to check out this group of basically 40 or 50 guys that would meet together. It was like a new startup political party. Never really did anything, but the I think it was the German Workers Party. And so he went to spy this thing out and listened to these speeches being given, and stood up and started. Like, he wasn't staying undercover very well, apparently. He stood up and made a counter speech to the speech that this guy just made. And everybody's like, wow, this guy's an amazing orator. This guy, he just blew us all away, and we all believed what he said, and we should offer him membership. And so they contacted him and said, hey, we want you to be a member in the German Workers' Party. He was the 54th member. Great big party, you can tell. 54th member of this party. Well, he started being the one to give speeches and things, and what he focused on was his belief that it was the communists and the Jews that had caused the loss of World War I, that every problem in German society was the Jews' fault. And so, and plus he manipulated people's fear of a communist revolution, which seemed to be kind of a reality because communism was gaining in popularity as well. Single-handedly, in 1 year, Adolf Hitler transformed the German Workers' Party from 53 other guys. In 1 year, it was 3,000 people strong. Just because of his gift as a public speaker, and he would come out very mellow, you know, just talking very low-key and stuff like that. And he would be, I hate to compare him to an evangelist, but he would... As his speech would progress, he would whip the crowd into a frenzy, and with these hand gestures and everything, and people would be just amazed and blown away and would believe what he was saying. So going from 53 people to 3,000 inside of 1 year, they also changed the name. The German Workers' Party became known as the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which if you basically abbreviate that in German, you get the word Nazi, National Socialist German Workers' Party. That makes more sense if I read it into German, but I don't read German and I don't even try to pronounce it. By 1925, so this is just 5 years later, 27,000 members of the Nazi Party. Hitler was very charismatic at the podium. He, like I said, he could whip the crowd into a frenzy, and really, they would just buy into it. And he was manipulating people's fear of communism and their hatred of the Jews. And that's basically what his two main points were. By 1929, just 4 years after that, 108,000. Remember, he was the 54th member. And inside of 10 years, they went from 54 people to 108,000 people. By 1932, just 3 years later, just the paramilitary unit of this Workers' Party, 400,000, called brown shirts. You might know them better as stormtroopers. He put them in uniforms. It was a brilliant idea because what it did was it made very visible brown shirts and the swastika that he had come up with on the white field or with the red stripe To really point out it was an intimidation tactic, and it was a look at our numbers, we're growing. And people would see these brown shirts walking around in their uniforms. They looked like some sort of military unit, and there was a lot of them. There was 400,000 of them by 1932. And so also what he managed to do was they seemed to be, I don't want to say they were above the law, but it seemed that they were above the law. They were able to intimidate people. They were able to, beat people up, basically to mug people, to intimidate and terrorize people if they publicly stood against what the speeches Hitler was making. And so it became a very fearful thing of, you know, you don't mess with the Nazi Party, with this German Workers' Party. Well, 1933, the Great Depression had totally devastated not just the United States previously, but the whole world currently at that point. And the existing German government was crumbling apart. Adolf Hitler, again, I'm abbreviating. If you come up to me later and say, well, this happened and this happened, I know those things happen. I'm trying to pack all this into an hour. Adolf Hitler was made Chancellor of Germany. He actually tried an overthrow earlier, which ended up basically humiliating him, and he spent 9 months in prison. You would think that would have been the end of it, but he actually decided to play the political game instead of the revolutionary game, ended up becoming the Chancellor of Germany. And when he was made chancellor of the German nation, he began by having communists arrested. And they were concentrated in groups, imprisoned in these large buildings, you know, old factories, old army barracks and things. And these camps where the communists were concentrated in were called concentration camps. And the purpose was to basically reprogram these people through very strict military-style drills and punishment and a lot of propaganda and basically brainwashing to reintegrate them as good Hitler-following German citizens. That was the point. The original concentration camps were occupied by the communists, arrested that first as Hitler's first order of business as chancellor. Well, within weeks, Hitler was able to change the German constitution to essentially allow himself to become dictator. So, and that's what he ended up becoming, was Germany's dictator. Democracy was gone in Germany. And as a result, then he was able to freely focus his attention on the real point of his hatred, which was the Jews. And that's how he had risen to power. That's how he had gotten 53 guys to turn into literally hundreds of thousands. Because of the hatred of the Jews. British and American newspapers were following this, and they published stories that were not very flattering about Adolf Hitler and about what had happened in Germany. Well, what Hitler did, it was actually quite brilliant, was he did the same thing that the governments of Europe had been doing for years and said, well, these things are being propagated by the worldwide Jewish community. And since we don't have control over the world, we just have control over our Germany, we should punish the Jews here, who are obviously informing the worldwide Jewish community, who are then, you know, leading these newspapers to publish these not very nice things about me. So what he did was he called for a boycott of Jewish shops in Germany. And remember, they're integrated into society now. They're all over the place. And so a boycott is called. The boycott was enforced. It was made more successful by brown shirts, by Nazi stormtroopers, basically standing in front of every known Jewish-owned shop or place of business or office and threatening to beat up or kill anybody that walked into the shop that day. So it was a very effective boycott. And a week later, then, a law was passed requiring that anybody who held a civil service job in Germany had to be Aryan. So basically what he did is he managed to fire every Jew working for the government because of this law, which was very successful because of this sense of nationalism and hatred of the Jews. And I'm going to abbreviate a lot of this stuff, but he was able in a very short period of time to pass laws that effectively hamstrung the Jews. They could do almost nothing. And you look back at it now and say, how could he get away with that? How could he not get away with that? He was the dictator. And so laws came progressively, sometimes day after day. Laws would be issued day after day, and each time, you know, saying, okay, a doctor cannot work in a state-owned hospital. There's our Jewish doctor cannot work in a state-owned hospital. There's the law. And then, you know, a Jewish lawyer cannot represent anybody who is this, you know, and get very, very specific and then broaden those things out. And so, like dominoes, law after law is passed, are passed, which successively limited the position of Jews in business, in education, in government, in the military, and in culture itself. I mean, it got to the point where laws were being passed saying Jews cannot go to a public park. A Jew cannot go to a swimming pool. You know, this sort of things. And then the books of Jewish authors were gathered up in the libraries and burned publicly. By 1935, Jews had been banned from restaurants. All restaurants in Germany, no Jew could be served in a restaurant in Germany by 1935. And even entire neighborhoods. And progressively, they were being focused tighter and tighter. The Nuremberg Laws, You might be familiar with that if you're a student of history, which essentially defined who is a citizen of Germany. And of course, you had to be Aryan. So the Nuremberg Laws, essentially in one fell swoop with one signature, took away the civil rights, all civil rights as citizens of Germany, took them all away from every Jew. With the stroke of a pen, suddenly every Jew living in Germany, even the ones, like I said, that had fought in World War I in the German army, that had been part of society just because they were Jews, suddenly they were not even second-class citizens. They were not citizens at all. They had no human rights. They had no civil rights, just with the passing of the Nuremberg Laws. So, and that was for people of even partial Jewish descent. So if one of your four grandparents was Jewish, you are no longer a citizen of Germany. Now, meanwhile, the concentration camp model has been refined and has spread. Dachau was the first one that followed this that kind of had refined it and made it work. Somebody shared with me this morning that when they were stationed in Germany, they went on essentially what they thought was a sightseeing tour to Dachau. Ended up staying there for the entire day. To this day, he's radically affected by this. That this concentration camp basically combined torturous discipline, military-style drills, and complete degradation of humanity against all critics of Adolf Hitler. Anybody who is a perceived enemy, including just, you know, we think he might someday not like us kind of thing. And, of course, all Jews. The idea of the concentration camp of let's gather them up and put them here. Well, by this time, the Jews of Germany know very clearly, we have to get out of here. We have to leave. Unfortunately, many of the nations of the world, I'd like to say they turned their back on them, but they didn't even do that. They gathered in July 1938, there was the Evian Conference. Evian, like the water. The Evian Conference, where basically most of the nations of the world said, we don't want your problems. We don't want this. We don't want the Jews. Many of them were professionals, very well educated. And so there were nations that said, well, we don't want a big influx of intelligent professional people. Because that would, you know, that would like put them above our own citizens who are largely not intelligent or educated or whatever. This is dead serious here. Even nations like the United States said, well, you know, we have immigration limits and we're not going to let anyone immigrate beyond these numbers that we've established. So there was a very limited number of places to which they could go. And many of them by this point had been so impoverished, they were so poor. By the laws that had been passed, they'd lost their jobs and now are starving, living in poverty. They couldn't afford to go anywhere, even if there was somewhere to go. Well, within months, the Night of Broken Glass, if you're familiar with this, this was the order that was given to destroy within the 50th Brigade, which is neither here nor there. Essentially, the order was given, destroy every Jewish synagogue in Germany. And so in one night, this is called the Night of Broken Glass. Again, it's a historical event that you can read about. But in one night, 267 synagogues were completely destroyed. About 1,000 prayer halls. 7,500 Jewish-owned stores and offices totally ransacked and burned. As well as many Jewish hospitals and schools and homes and cemeteries. 91 Jews were murdered that night throughout Germany. And 26,000 more were arrested and put in the concentration camps. This is amazing to watch how quickly this happened. It's almost beyond belief. And yet, you can see the films even today of these were real events. These were real people that this really happened to in our parents or maybe our grandparents or maybe your lifetime that these things happened. At this point, the idea of emigration just became a full-blown panic, and many Jews in Germany just fled, just out and out, you know, grabbed their children and did what they could to get into another country, you typically one of the neighboring countries. But if you're familiar with Germany's history at this era, you know that fleeing into a neighbor country is only a temporary reprieve. In 1938, Hitler had assimilated Austria, and the next year, Czechoslovakia. And then, all-out war. We call it the beginning of World War II. It was Germany's invasion of Poland. This was September 1st, 1939, if you're following the timeline. At that point, there was between 2 and 3 million Jews in Poland. And to say that they suffered terribly is a gross understatement. As a matter of fact, pretty much I've got 3 more pages of notes, and just about everything I have to say from here on out is a gross understatement. There's no words that I can find to describe just about any of this. The Jews in Poland, you know, many of them still in outlying communities, smaller communities, well, they were rounded up and put into larger communities forcibly. So they would take 5 or 6 or 8 of these communities and gather them all together. They wanted the Jews in one place. They wanted them identified, not just by their faces, but by the identifying marks, be it in most cases, it was the yellow Star of David that had to be affixed to the front and back of their clothing. They had to be identified. They were gathered together. And then those communities would be gathered into even larger communities. And ultimately, it would get to the point where they would be brought to a ghetto. Now, I don't use the word ghetto as I would say today, where you go to the bad side of town and we call it the ghetto. No, the ghetto was actually a number of city blocks, sometimes one block, sometimes a number of city blocks, but they would be walled in, brick walled in. Every entrance or exit from there would be bricked up, and then there would be a main entrance or exit guarded by Nazis, by Nazi stormtroopers. And all these communities that had been gathered up would be put together. All these Jews from all over the place would be gathered into this ghetto. And essentially, it was a prison because they couldn't go out. They could go out to work, but they, you know, they had to check in and out if they had jobs. The majority of them did not. And food, you know, they had no business in there. They had no agriculture in there. By the way, these were always in the major cities, and they were always very near the railroads. They would give them rations of food, which it's sad. It's interesting, but it's sad that you read the actual memorandums, these letters that German Nazi officials sent back and forth saying, you know, one guy saying, "We're spending too much money putting food into these ghettos," and the guy overseeing the ghetto says, "Their rations are a third of what we give people in prison, inmates in prison. And by the way, the food you're sending us is all the rotten food that the military can't eat. So they never got a vegetable that wasn't rotten. They never got meat that wasn't full of bugs. I mean, it was a third as much, and it was inedible." And in the ghettos, the Jews began very quickly to die of starvation and of disease, and many of them of exposure. So it became a place just to suffer and die. Well, eventually, the Jews in the ghetto would be gathered up, would be transported, told that they're going to be transported again. Many of them had no reason to believe otherwise because they had been moved so many times. Well, we're moving you again, so you need to report to the railroad station. They'd be packed into rail cars, often to the limit, I mean, to the physical limit of as many people standing up as can possibly be fit into a rail car, where everyone is so tightly packed that when one of the thousands of people who died just on their way And thousands did die just on their way because there was no heat in these things and they were going through, it would be 12 below zero at times. And many would die. Well, they were packed so tightly that the ones who died would remain standing, sandwiched in between everyone else who was packed into these railroad cars. And of course, they were going to the death camps, to the concentration camps, which were really not about the reprogramming, not in regards to the Jews. It was about the final solution to the Jewish question that appears all through the Germans' writings of that day, all of their political memoranda and everything. They're always talking about the final solution to the Jewish question, which is the extermination of the Jewish race. There was no other solution to the Jewish problem than to rid the world of all Jews. So then the ghettos very often would be filled again with more Jews being imported in, only to be loaded on railroad cars at some point in the future and then taken to the concentration camps. This procedure that was followed in Poland, we've been talking about Poland, except this procedure, because if you're familiar with World War II, you know that Germany invaded quite a number of countries. Russia, Romania, Hungary, Lithuania, Netherlands, France, Latvia, Yugoslavia, Greece, Belgium, the list goes on. And in every one of these countries, that same model was followed. Sometimes with exception. Sometimes they would just kill the Jews where they stood. Other times they tried to be more organized about it. They were keeping meticulous records. So Poland served as the training ground for this. This is how they established the process. The scene at the concentration camps to which they were taken, those that actually survived the ghetto and survived the rail trip to the concentration camp, that's indescribable. I can give you words, and they only mean as much to you as they mean to you. Inhuman treatment. Again, as I said before, all of these words fall horribly short to really communicate this. Inhuman treatment, treating people like they are not human. Torture, beyond belief torture. Humiliation. Certainly starvation, disease, slave labor, medical experimentation. That alone is a source of grievous historical study that you can do. And mass execution, including the gas chambers. As I went through all this stuff, it's impossible for me to even know where to begin to try to describe the conditions in the concentration camps. They're profoundly disturbing. That even a light read, just skimming what happened, if you're a human being with a conscience, it affects you grievously. There's no statistics that I could give you. There's no photos that I could show. And there are plenty of photos. There's no film that I could have you watch. There's no description I could make that could possibly ever accurately depict what the Nazis did to the Jews in those years. Not just Jews. Again, there were the Gypsies and the Communists and others, but the vast majority of the people that the Nazis did this to were the Jews. Between, I don't know if you can fathom this, between 1941 and 1945, a four-year period, the amount of time that we usually keep a president in the White House, the amount of time that you went to high school, in a four-year period, one half of the Jews in Europe were murdered by the Nazis. Half of them. I should say by the Nazis and their collaborators, because very often they were able to utilize the anti-Semitism of the general population, certainly of the military and of the local police, and were able to use them to do this as well. We could literally spend weeks, and I've forced myself to just spend the hour on this, and that's it, and then move on. But we could literally spend weeks hearing and listening to the stories of the torture and the horror, and still never really come to the place where we understand what went on. The only thing I can really do in this media, in this, you know, I have this written word on the page in front of me. I'm speaking to you. Maybe you're hearing this on a CD or a cassette, but the only way I can really even begin to do this is I decided to take just one account, just one, almost completely at random, not completely at random, because I purposely did not choose one of the thousands of stories of people who endured the concentration camps. I purposely did not do that because I think that within the walls, within the fences of the concentration camp, we have a tendency to isolate that. What I did was I decided to pick a story of somebody who witnessed what went on, not even firsthand account, of somebody who witnessed something that went on in their own town. And I thought that this would help us a little. Not a lot, but I think it'll help us a little. This is, by the way, as disturbing as this is, it's by no means even comes close to being the worst of what could be shared. This is the affidavit of a construction engineer. The guy's name is Hermann. And Hermann Friedrich Grabe. He witnessed the execution of some Jews in Dubno, Ukraine, and this is taken from the book called The Yellow Star, published not by a Jew, but by a German, as I recall, in the 1960s, maybe early 1970s, and recently translated into English. It's called The Yellow Star by Gerhard Schoenberger. Gerhard Schoenberger. It's called The Yellow Star. Hermann was visiting one of the building sites at the company that he worked for. He's a construction engineer. He's a contractor, okay? And he shows up. He says, on October 5th, this is a quote. Everything I'm about to read to you is a quote. On October 5th, 1942, when I visited the building office at Dubno, my foreman, Hubert Moenikes, told me that in the vicinity of the site, Jews from Dubno had been shot in three large pits, each about 100 feet long and 10 feet deep. About 1,500 people were killed daily. All of the 5,000 Jews who still lived in Dubno before the pogrom were to be liquidated. As the shooting had taken place in his presence, he was still very upset. Then I accompanied Moenikes to the building site and saw near the building site large mounds of earth, about 100 feet long and about 6.5 feet high. In front of the mounds stood some trucks from which people were being shoved out by armed Ukrainian militia under the supervision of an SS man. It's a Nazi. The militiamen were the truck guards and drove them back and forth to the ditch. All these people had the yellow stars prescribed for Jews on the front and back of their clothing, so they were identifiable as Jews. Moenikes and I went straight to the pits, and nobody stopped us. I heard a quick succession of shots from behind one of the mounds of earth. Those who had gotten off the trucks, men, women, and children of all ages, had to undress upon the order of an SS man who carried a riding or dog whip. They had to put their clothes on separate piles, shoes, outerwear, and underwear. I saw a heap of shoes that must have contained 800 to 1,000 pairs, great piles of clothes and undergarments. Without screaming or weeping, these people undressed, stood in family groups. kissed each other, said their farewells, and waited for a sign from another SS man who stood near the pit, also with a whip in his hand. During the 15 minutes that I stood near the pit, I did not hear anyone complain or beg for mercy. I watched a family of about 8, a man and a woman, both about 50, with their children, aged about 1, 8, and 10, and 2 grown-up daughters of about 20 to 24. An old woman with snow-white hair was holding the 1-year-old child in her arms, singing something to it and tickling it. The child was crowing with delight. The man and wife were looking on with tears in their eyes. The father was holding the hand of a boy of about 10, speaking to him softly. The boy was fighting back his tears. The father pointed to the sky, stroked the boy's head, and seemed to explain something to him. At that moment, the SS man at the pit shouted something to his comrade, who rounded up about 20 people and ordered them to go behind of the mound of earth. Among them was the family that I have mentioned. I still clearly remember a dark-haired, slim girl who pointed to herself as she passed close to me and said, 23. I walked to the other side of the mound and found myself standing before an enormous grave. The people lay so closely packed, one on top of the other, that only their heads were visible. Nearly all had blood running over their shoulders from their heads. Some of them were still moving. Some lifted an arm and turned a head to show that they were still alive. The pit was already 2/3 full. I estimated that it already contained about 1,000 people. I looked around for the man who had shot them. He was an SS man who was sitting on the edge of the narrow end of the pit, his legs dangling into it. He had a submachine gun across his knees and was smoking a cigarette. The people, completely naked, went down some steps that had been cut in the clay wall of the pit and climbed over the heads of those already laying there to the place indicated by the SS man. They lay down in front of the dead or injured people. Some of them caressed those who were still alive and spoke to them softly. Then I heard a series of shots. I looked into the pit and saw that their bodies were twitching, or that the heads lay motionless on top of the bodies that lay before them. Blood was pouring from their necks. I was surprised that I had not been ordered away, but saw that there were also 2 or 3 postmen standing nearby. The next batch was already approaching. They climbed up into the pit, lined up against the previous victims, and were shot. When I walked back around the mound, I noticed another truckload of people that had just arrived. This time it included sick and infirmed people. A very thin old woman with terribly thin legs was undressed by others who were already naked, while 2 people supported her. The woman appeared to be paralyzed. The naked people carried the woman around the mound. I left with Moenikes and drove back to Dubno in the car. These are real people. Mom and dad and grandma and the kids. It's one really one really small story. And whether you just feel connected to a few of the people in that family or all the 20 people that were shot or the 20 people that were shot before them or the 20 people that were shot after them or the truckloads of people that were brought in, the 1,500 people that were killed there every day until all 5,000 of the Jews in that town were in the pit. Many of them not killed by the bullet, certainly wounded by the bullets, but who drowned in the blood of the people who came after them. However you may feel connected to that, it doesn't begin to describe the magnitude by which this happened. Again, the concentration camps were worse than this. And I tried to figure out a way to kind of describe to you what it is that happened in the 1940s. We're in the year 2005. This is 60 to 64 years ago. This is Mom and Dad's lifetime for me. And I tried to come up with a way to describe it. The magnitude of it. And to understand how many Jews were killed by the Nazis and their collaborators from Hitler's rise to power until the end, you would have to take the entire population of Wyoming. Every man, woman, and child in Wyoming. And kill them. And then take the entire population of Montana, man, woman, and child, and kill them. And then take the entire population of Colorado, man, woman, and child, and kill them. That's the scale of murder that the Nazis perpetrated against the Jews. And we can't even imagine that. The conclusion of people who try to educate people about the Holocaust is all they can come up with is two words. Never forget.